Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Well, growing up, Anne O'Connor knew her father was touchy. She'd often been in trouble for slamming the door, for instance. Her father stood over her on one occasion until, anxious and afraid, she could close the door very, very silently. For years, Anne and her brother knew nothing of why their father could be moody, edgy, depressed, crying and angry, all without apparent reason, and very confusing for lively children, you can imagine. They grew up in Preston, in Victoria. They learned there was nothing to be done. They lived with it. After all, their mother lived with it. And many families in that area did as well. This was a place that had a lot of returned men, and he'd returned from World War II with a secret that was never told until a long time after his death. In fact, it was when their mother was quite an old woman that the children learned the horrible truth about what was wrong with their dad. There'd been an awful accident in Papua New Guinea during his service in Lae in World War II. Their mother had shared that secret with him well past his death. And that secret would have remained a secret, except that it was revealed to one of Anne's brothers when he attended an Anzac service, when he went to the march to march with his father's old compatriots. Anne Connor has turned this true story into two generations. It's a fictionalised remembering of her parents' relationship and the secrets and the childhood of Anne herself and of her siblings. And we began by speaking about what so many of us have probably done unwittingly as young children, and I'm sure regret, sitting with a returned man and saying, "What did you do in the war?"
I have a vivid memory of that, and I must have been 8 or 10, maybe 11, and we were in the lounge room, and there was just the two of us, which was unusual considering, there were five children and two parents, and the house wasn't a very big house. And I remember asked him the question, "Dad, did you shoot anyone in the war?" Now, why I asked that question, I don't know. I don't know what was going on around me. Was it around Anzac Day? Were there some stories going on around me? And he was very quiet for a few moments. And then he said to me, "Don't ever ask anyone who's been to war that question, because they may have and they may not want to talk about it."
How old were you when that exchange took place?
Probably about, I reckon, 10 or 11. Not old. Not very old. And that stayed with me. I didn't take it any further. I wasn't that inquisitive about it, obviously, and I didn't take that any further. But that stuck with me.
It must have made you wonder, though.
Yes. Yes, I did, but I wondered about other people. I didn't wonder about my father. It's hard to imagine your father doing something like that, because Jock was a gentleman. He was a depressed man. Now we know that. At the time, he just seemed aloof and a bit moody and reactionary to especially loud noises, and I've written about that in the book on three occasions.
You've written about banging doors and getting into trouble.
Yes, that initial scene of the sliding door, I closed that too strongly and it banged.
Isn't it interesting that stays with you, though? Something that's
a powerful scene as a little kid.
Yeah.
And the power of it was confusion mainly. Why the strong? I remember thinking, why is this happening when it was just a door banging? I don't think I banged it on purpose. Maybe I did. I can't remember what happened before. But I do remember at the time this being very confusing, why he was doing this to me.
What was his reaction when the door slammed?
His reaction was, it was a sliding door, so it banged into the door frame. And he yelled at me and said, "Don't ever bang the door, open it again." So he made me open it a number of times until I closed it very silently. And then when I did that, he made me do it again. So it was this sort of repetition of open it again, close it, open it again. So from my perspective, when my hand was shaking when I had in the handle, because there was a lot at stake at me getting this right.
Yes.
And then when I was closed it to his satisfaction, he walked into the lounge room and he sat down, slumped into the chair, and his chest was moving. I remember his chest moving in and out, and he was very flushed in the face.
No, he also had bad reactions to Crackernight, didn't he?
Crackernight, that when he came back. And as kids, we were never allowed to have crackers. We were never allowed to go to Crackernight. We were never allowed to have any type of fireworks or penny bungers or anything like that. It was just forbidden. No explanation. It was just forbidden, as if it was a very bad thing. And then when he came back, he was discharged from the repatriation hospital here in Melbourne in March 1945. And that year, November 1945, there was a scene that it's Crackernight, and Bess wanted to go to Crackernight. The kids had built a big bonfire down the street, and Bess had wanted to go to that with Jock as a family, with Cleary, and he didn't go. And then that scene preempts him talking about what had happened to him in New Guinea to Bess.
Bess is your mum and Cleary is of your brothers. That's and our guest on Open House is Anne Connor. She's written an extraordinary memoir of her father and told in a way that you're living that story. You've written it as a novel, but these are events that happened within your family. I just wonder from a writer's perspective how you're able to leap from this is my story, my autobiography, or at least the story of my family, to it being out there, the story about others who you've named, Jock and Bess, not Dad and Mum.
Well, structurally, from a writer's perspective, it was difficult to write. Take away the content and the emotional content as the daughter of Jock and Bess. Structurally, it was very difficult to write because I wanted his perspective. I thought, well, what was it like for him? I almost wanted a camera on his shoulder just to try and capture his world so that he's more present in it. I didn't want it all about me. I wanted it about his story and my parents' story. Because when I unpacked that story of them, what they went through, it was quite incredible what they went through as a couple.
And well, let's talk a little bit about that because it forms the centrepiece of the book and in many ways the centrepiece of your life while you didn't know it at the time. Take me to the day when your brother, Galvin, went to Anzac Day and marched with some of your father's former comrades after his death.
That was in 1991, and my father died in 1973. So we're looking at nearly two decades. And Galvin wanted to connect with the 2nd 14th Field Regiment, Australian Field Regiment. So he went to Anzac Day, and one of the fellows there was introducing him to men from Jock's regiment. And one of them said to Galvin, my brother, I was there when Jock shot such and such, and it was just blurted out like that. And that's how we found out. It was just a blurt from an old veteran.
That wouldn't have made any sense to your brother because your father had never spoken about shooting anybody. The horrible realisation was that the person who was shot was his mate.
Yes. That's right, 22-year-old. And in the book, I've actually fictionalised that young man's name because when I spent 2 days at the Australian War Memorial in the library researching this book, and I found out we didn't know his name at that stage, so I had to do a bit of research to find out this person's name. When I found his name, I requested his army records and they were sent to me 3 weeks later unopened, which means no one had found out how he had died. In the report it had Jock Connor's something like, in scratchy old writing, Jock Connor's submachine gun accidentally discharged and shot such and such in the head, who died 20 minutes later on the way to hospital. So this boy, his family would have received a telegram saying died on active service, and he's buried in the Lae cemetery. So that's what this family, he was from WA, from Western Australia, that's what this family would have received. So I didn't feel it was up to me to expose that boy's, that young man's name, so I've fictionalised his name, because his descendants would think that he died on active service, which he did, but it's got so much more depth to the story than that.
How did you receive the news when you found out, well after your father's death, that that's why he was so sensitive about you asking him, did you shoot anyone in the war?
Well, I felt great sadness. I remember my first, and it's still there, you know, just great sadness for him that he went through this and carried it. My mother knew, and he had this dreadful guilt. His Catholicism was very important to him, so he would have had massive guilt to live with. And that's what I felt. I just felt so sad for him that he went through this, and the unfairness of it, that he was a victim of war through no fault of his own. He
Yes.
became a living victim of war through no fault of his own. So I felt enormous sadness about that.
You imagine a scene in the book then when your father, Jock, talks to the local parish priest about this very issue.
Yes. That's Finbar Henrik is a character in the book, and he's based on a priest down here in Melbourne called Brosnan, John Brosnan, who was the parish priest at Pentridge. And Jock and Brosnan were good mates, and Jock used to visit prisoners in Pentridge. He was very involved in the St. Vincent de Paul Society, and he would go to Pentridge with Brosnan, Father Brosnan, and they would visit prisoners in Pentridge, which is a jail down here in Melbourne for very hardened criminals, murderers, rapists, bank robbers. But the conversation, I imagine, with Finbar Henrik, who is based on Brosnan, is that Henrik was asking Jock to imagine how he would be if a friend of his had the same experience. What would he be saying to his friend? And Jock found that difficult to do that. And then Finbar Henrik asks him, well, what was it like at home? Was there any forgiveness at home? So it's I was using that imagination, that scene, to sort of tease out what a counsellor or what a confessor might say to Jock to help him come to some sort of understanding within himself.
And you wrote, the priest looked over his glasses, watching his friend suffer. The past is the past. You can't change it, Jock. Jesus forgave sinners. It's time you forgave yourself.
Mm.
He reached his hand across the table and rested it on Jock's forearm. It was an accident, a tragic accident. That's what happens in war. It wasn't your fault. But is there any sense in your memory that your father had ever come to terms with that, that he had either known Jesus' forgiveness or, in fact, known the forgiveness of himself?
No, I don't.
No.
I don't. I don't think he ever felt forgiven. Towards the end of his life, he had a mysterious pain in his right arm, which would give him absolute hell, especially through Melbourne's cold winters.
Yes.
And there has been research done that guilt or unexpressed guilt and rage can manifest as pain in the body. To me, mysterious pain in the right arm, he was right-handed, reeks of, you know, this is what he was experiencing. Mm. He was experiencing that guilt and that pain still. On his records, when he was discharged from the repatriation hospital, on his records it had court-martial pending. So the army never forgave him, and this court-martial just floated into the air. I couldn't find any record of it.
Mm.
He wasn't court-martialed, but there was still that in the air, that the army thought that he should have been court-martialed, or there was some discussion about that.
And never so finalised. You can't live with ongoing guilt or uncertainty like that, can you?
That's right. That's right. So I think he would have felt... I don't think he forgave himself, I think, in answer to your question. I think he took that to his grave, my understanding. Maybe he... Maybe towards the end of his life he did, but the jock I knew, I didn't see that forgiveness within him.
Oh, dear. Our guest on Open House is the author of this amazing book called Two Generations. Anne Connor is with us. You've written this about your mum. Bess kept Jock's secret until she was an old woman in her 90s, but no doubt missed the man she fell in love with. That sentence, that little clause, no doubt missed the man she fell in love with, resonates with me, resonates with everybody, I'm sure. There were a few brief moments you've written when he returned to his loving, funny, easy-to-be-with self, but perhaps these times were fleeting. So everybody's life has changed, your mum who knew about it, and I'm wondering about you. How were you able, if you have been, to accommodate the reality, the truth about what happened to your dad, the tragedy upon tragedy, into your own story?
Well, I think intergenerational trauma is a difficult one, but I think for me, I had to explore that. I had to explore the effect it had on me, and I did that with some a couple of professional people who helped me look at the intergenerational trauma and to help me pick out the good bits of my parents and let go of the bad bits and to have more empathy for their parents and to let go of the blame. And I couldn't have written this book if I hadn't have done that personal work myself, because I think I would have just got stuck in the emotion of it. I must say, during the writing, I wept buckets. You know, it was just, as you can imagine, you know, just when his experience came up, when I read his records, all those sorts of things, that there's so much about the people we love that we don't know. That I find that really fascinating too, that he had this whole story that I didn't know about, and yet, you know, I was close to him. I find that fascinating too. But there were difficult times, many difficult times during the writing of it, but it was such a very good thing to do, to come out the other side and think, well, they were pretty terrific. You know, my parents were pretty terrific, ordinary people, very ordinary people, but they had this trauma that they dealt with the best way that they could. And most of us, I think, Stephen, do the best we can with the cards that we are dealt. Most of us, I think, do that.
Yes.
And I think they did. They did the best that they could with what they were given, and that's really all of what any of us can do. Really, I think.
That's Anne Connor, a story of acceptance, a story of tragedy upon tragedy, ultimately a story about, I guess, guilt. And if there was a failure there to receive forgiveness, What an extra tragedy that is. The end of that book is quite amazing. I'm not going to spoil it by sharing it with you, spoiler alert, but the way Anne imagines how her father may have ended his days in a nursing home is really touching, and it's kind of how you hope it may have turned out. But look, the book is called Two Generations. Anne Connor is the author. She's a Melbourne woman who's written other pieces, but never a novel. And this is an extraordinary one. She runs a narrative arc through the story. So it's based on the real events of her family. But she writes it as a novel, imagining conversations that might have taken place, but bringing to mind her own memories of those events. It's published by Ventura. Gosh, they do a lot of good work. It's Anne Connor. I wonder, what is it that you need to be forgiven for? And have you known that forgiveness? It so often starts with just going to God and fessing up. Because sometimes that's not just all we can do, it's the best we can do.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.